This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Last week we indulged the sort of dreamier, more aspirational parts of our characters by talking about hypercars. And this week we're offsetting all of that and bringing ourselves back down to earth with an episode all about hot hatches. Frankly, hot hatches mean more to me than hypercars do anyway. Andrew, I suspect they probably resonate more with you as well.
Don't know. Interesting. Well, hypercars, yes, definitely. Because hypercars are rare and rarefied things, aren't they? And hot hatches are part of our absolute everyday lives. You know, we've owned them, we've driven, we've done everything. So yes. I think there's space for both. But you know, I'm really, really looking forward to this. Not least because I think there is a kind of a suspicion out there that we have frankly disappeared up our own fundaments and can only consider cars if they've got at least 1,000 horsepower. And it would be nice at least to show that we do. We're not quite as monodimensional as that.
Yeah, quite right. We have been sort of planning this episode of the podcast for a while. Lots of people have asked for it as well. So now is the time to do it. I've spent a few days recently in an Up GTI, a VW Up GTI, which is a very flawed car, but it's hugely good fun. Andrew, can you remind us what you're running as a long-termer right now?
I am running a Ford Focus ST, a very orange Ford Focus ST, which is... You know, the funny thing is, and I wrote about this on Drive Nation, having had, frankly, a fairly ridiculous couple of fortnights in which I've driven all sorts of things, you know, the Speedtail, the SF90, and F8, and NSX, and so, you get back into an absolutely everyday common or garden hot hatch, and you kind of think, wouldn't you, that it would be like, oh, well, you know. That was fun. Here we are, back to reality. But it's not like that at all. It's, you know, it doesn't diminish it at all. You get in it and you enjoy it for exactly the same reasons you enjoyed it before you drove all the stupid stuff. And it's one of the things I like about it. And I think partly that's because they're just so usable, because you can extract so much of the potential from them in a way that you simply can't in even an F8, let alone an SF90. Where you're always, you know, just sort of chipping away, using 20% here, 30% there, you know, maybe 40%, but then, oh, you frighten yourself and you go, and whereas, you know, you get into an Up GTI and you're just, you know, 98% everywhere you go, aren't you?
Exactly right. I've just written almost exactly that for Pistonheads. It's all about how much of a car's performance you can use. And hot hatches, perhaps more so than any other type of performance car on the road, allow you to use their performance. That's why they're so fun. But let's go all the way back to the start, the origins of the hot hatch. And Andrew, as any idiot knows, it all started with the Golf GTI in 1976. Go.
Except it didn't. It's like you think of any famous car which is famous for doing a certain thing, it almost certainly didn't do it. The Land Rover wasn't the first SUV, the Range Rover wasn't the first luxury SUV, the Espace wasn't the first MPV, and the Golf GTI certainly wasn't the first hot hatch. I can go on and on forever about this sort of stuff. Before that, there was an Auto Bianchi and there was a Simca, but you know, it's fair to say it's kind of like, the de Havilland Comet being the jet that pioneered the jet age. But in fact, nobody remembers that. Everybody remembers that Boeing came along with a thing called the 707, and everybody thinks that was the first commercially successful jetliner. So what Volkswagen did, which was so clever, was it recognised that the idea was really, really good and did something proper with it. But it certainly wasn't Volkswagen's idea at all. I suppose the Golf GTI was the one that created the legend of the hot hatch, certainly, because there wasn't a thing such as a hot hatch before that. You know, there were hatchbacks that were slightly faster than the normal hatchbacks they were based upon, but the whole concept, and certainly the name, didn't exist before the Golf GTI, but it wasn't the first.
Yeah, exactly. So it's perhaps not unreasonable that it's credited with being sort of genesis for this type of car. Although, you know, you've mentioned a few of the earlier ones, and I think even if you go back to the early 1960s when the first Mini Cooper arrived, it didn't have a hatchback technically, but that's semantics, isn't it? Because it's still a hotter version of a otherwise very ordinary car, and so it's not much of a leap to go from a Mini Cooper to, you know, a hatchback that happens to have a hatchback boot. Hotter engine.
The other great example, which also, it actually got a hatch very late in life, but certainly in the early 1970s, long before the Golf was around, the Alfa Sud. You know, that was a car, you know, an 1.3 Alfa Sud TI was a hot hatch in all but hatch. I mean, it had, you know, in the 1970s, it had a 5-speed gearbox, it had disc brakes, it had independent rear spin. I mean, it was, you know, it was just a complete class above, you know, anything else you can get, but it didn't have a hatchback. So these days it's not regarded as being, you know, part of the category. But to me, it absolutely is. You're completely correct.
And the French performance car enthusiasts will be on our backs if we don't mention the fact that the Renault 5 Alpine, or the Gordini in the UK, was on sale here, or throughout Europe, I suppose, 2 months before the Golf GTI in 1966.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, so
do you remember the wheels, the alloy wheels that those things have, those three stud alloy wheels? It was a really, really good looking car. I've never driven one, but I'd like to. I can't imagine there are that many left, but yeah, absolutely right.
That's a good question. There can't be many Renault 5 Gordinis on the road in the UK. Maybe we need to look that up. Okay, so I think we can probably agree that the Golf GTI in the mid-70s, although it wasn't the first ever hot hatch, it was the one that brought the category to life. What are the sort of landmark hot hatches that spring to mind, aside from the Golf GTI? We did a podcast recently talking about the cars that we've owned, and you talk about the 205 GTI that you had. I mean, it's still one of the sort of apex hot hatches of that era, isn't it? It's one of the greats.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, you can remove the words of that era from your sentence. I don't think that anybody else has yet distilled better the essence of what a hot hatchback should be than Peugeot did with the 205 GTI, and well, it started in 1984. You know, it's a great looking car. It's extraordinarily light. It has a lovely, sweet spinning, normally aspirated, four-cylinder engine, loved, beautiful gearbox, and the most exquisite handling balance. And that's what it's all about. It's nothing clever. There's no sophisticated stuff on it, but it's what it's got done really, really well. And I, for myself, well, of course I would say this because I've got one, but I don't think that anyone has done it convincingly better than that in the, whatever it is, gosh, 35 years since.
Yeah. And there was something about that package as a whole, the 205 GTI. It became not just, we don't like this word, but it did become legendary. But it became so desirable, didn't it, in the 80s. It was such a sort of X factor car, and people wanted one. And actually, it was a little 205. I think that kind of demonstrates just how desirable, how likeable a good, a well-judged hot hatch can be.
Yeah, but you didn't think of it as being a 205 any more than you thought of a Golf GTI being a Mark 1 Golf. They were breeds apart. I mean, I know this because, you know, I had one back in the 80s because I briefly worked in the city and for once in my life had a bit of money. And at the age of, I was probably 20 or something, I went and bought a brand new 205 GTI. I think it's the only brand new car I've ever bought. And I bought it because obviously I just love the concept and the idea, but I also love the look, and it's exactly what you're talking about. It's just, it just captured something. It was the go-to car. I think in much the same way that the Mini Cooper was in the 1960s. Not that I'm quite old enough to remember that, but it just captured something. And I'm not sure that anything's done it better since, to be honest.
Yeah, it almost seems like a shame that today's hot hatches are trying harder and harder to be faster, more powerful, cleverer, more sophisticated machines. When you look at the basic ingredients in the really great hot hatches, they're actually very simple cars.
Yes, completely. Simplicity done well. It's all about, the setup. One of the reasons, I would say the reason, that the 205 GTI has sort of passed into folklore is because, you know, above everything else, it's an outstanding driver's car. And by that, I actually mean that if you didn't drive it properly, you could get into trouble. And I know this because with my old one, in the 1980s, before I knew how to drive, I got into trouble in it all the time until, you know, I figured out what to do. But it was responsive and it was rewarding and it was just a proper thing to do. It was so much more than a good looking hatch with a big fast engine in it. It was a properly resolved driving machine in its braking and its performance and its handling. It was the whole package. It was the real deal.
Okay, I'm going to set out my sort of generic blueprint for a hot hatch, and you can tell me what I've got right and what I've got wrong, where we agree and disagree. I think a hot hatch, apart from having a hatchback boot, should be a compact car. I mean, that should be a given that it's based on a conventional hatchback, but some hatchbacks nowadays are bigger, aren't they? But let's say it's a fairly compact car. I think it should have an amount of straight line performance that sort of elevates it over and above most everyday traffic on the road, but that remains usable. And I think it should have a type of handling that makes it fun and exciting to drive, but that isn't skewed towards outright performance or outright grip. And I think it should be relatively affordable, or at least within realistic reach. I think also that it needs to maintain a good degree of usability and practicality, at least as much as any other hatchback car. What are you adding or subtracting to and from that recipe?
I'm terrifyingly little. I mean, I hate to agree with you on everything because it's just boring, but I honestly think that is the essence of it. I mean, lightness to me is, but also things like, you know, it's got to, a hot hatchback, if it's to be credible, it's got to get the basics right. It's got to have, you know, decent seats that actually sort of hold you in place, because these are, you know, because these are all based on shopping cars and cars which aren't regularly going to be driven the way that we'd like to drive hot hatchbacks. There's lots of things that need to be done to them. They just need to be, I mean, fun is the word. I mean, okay, so you can't lose the practicality. That is the most important thing. I think that was so incredibly clever about both the 205, which is in packaging terms an absolute miracle, and the Golf GTI, which was just a new level of practicality and usability when it came out. So you can't lose that. So you retain all of that. You don't compromise any of it. But at the same time, within that structure, you just make it as fun as you can. And if that means that it oversteers when you lift off the throttle, then fine. Absolutely great. No worries at all. What do you think about things like turbochargers and four-wheel drive and all these things that we've seen over the years sort of get? Do they add to the experience, or do they detract, or is it very much case-specific?
Interesting point. Maybe it's case-specific, but I suspect that turbochargers were needed because people began to expect more power. Four-wheel drive was needed because the power outputs were growing higher and higher, and two driven wheels on the front axle couldn't put it all down to the road. So I think the basic recipe for a great hot hatch, if it's small enough, if it's light enough, is manual box, front wheel drive, modest but you know, energetic, revvy, normally aspirated engine. And sadly, if you look at those basic principles, there's no modern hot hatch that delivers those.
No. No, not least because they've all got turbochargers now, haven't they?
Yeah.
Just exactly. About.
Yeah, so it's, yeah, it's interesting. What do you reckon then? Do you think the hot hatch breed sort of peaked a few decades ago? Or do you think turbocharging and four-wheel drive have added to the game?
Okay. I don't think four-wheel drive has added to the game at all. I understand exactly what you mean about needing four-wheel drive to handle the power, but the point is the cars shouldn't have the power in the first place because that's not what those cars are about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if you ask me which Focus RS I would much most prefer to go out and drive now, the first or the most recent, I'd go and drive the first one because it was, you know, it had the right, so I think it had 217 horsepower, which it could easily deploy through the front wheels with a really good diff in it. And it was light and it was agile. Whereas the last one, I thought it was one of the most overrated cars I've driven. I thought it was heavy. I thought it was cumbersome. I didn't think that it had much feel to it. It was a bludgeon. It was a kind of a blunt instrument, which, you know, on paper all looked terribly impressive. But when you actually went out there and you drove the thing, I just found myself thinking, well, you know, what is all the fuss about? What have I missed? What have I misunderstood about this car? And I must have driven three or four over the time that it was out, and I never got to the bottom of it. So four-wheel drive, no. Turbochargers, I think two things. I think one is turbo technology has come on so far, and... You know, particularly with the Focus ST I've got, which has got quite a big engine in it. It's got 2.3 in it with a turbo on it. It is so responsive. So I think it sounds quite good. So I think that there are ways of mitigating the traditional shortcomings of turbochargers. But also, you know, we all know that modern cars, for, you know, tedious emissions and economy reasons, kind of have to have them because, you know, you couldn't have. And for packaging, really, you know, if you wanted to get, I mean, the Focus has got, I can't remember now, I think it's got like 270 horsepower. Well, if you wanted that out of a normally aspirated engine, you'd probably have to have 4 litres and you'd never get it under the bonnet. So, you know, it's a no-go. So I think turbochargers I find less objectionable than four-wheel drive. But frankly, I'd just much rather the cars were so light that they didn't need either.
Yeah, I completely agree. Right, I'm glad you mentioned the Mark III Ford Focus RS because in my episode notes here, it says... And we'll come back to this a little bit later on. It says, have an argument with Andrew about the Mark III Ford Focus RS. And mostly because I do have a slightly different point of view on that car. We'll come to it later.
Okay.
But I do have a slightly different point of view on that car. But mostly I want to talk about it because somebody sent us a note on Instagram saying, I enjoy the podcast. It would be great if you could find some topics that you disagree on.
Yeah, I saw that.
And this is one. So there we go. I think that would be interesting. We'll come to that later on. But back to this chat for now. So what do you reckon, how does a good hot hatch stack up to a proper purpose-built sports car? Because in theory, on paper, something like a Mazda MX-5, which is designed from the ground up to be a performance car, it's low, it's light, rear-wheel drive, really good chassis balance, all the rest of it. I mean, it's the basics are so much more right for a performance car than what is... actually an adapted shopping trolley, basically, you know. And yet I suspect if we when we get stuck into this, we'll find many hot hatches that we'd think we'd rather drive than many sports cars.
Do you know, funnily enough, I did for Autocar, must have been a couple of years back, a twin test between it was effectively a Fiat 124, you know, the Arbar thing, and a Honda Civic Type R, to answer this very question. And actually, the Arbath was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I really didn't have very high hopes for it. I guess because it's, you know, MX-5 based, and even a rather rubbish engine from Fiat couldn't completely mess that up. But in the end, I think I gave it to the Honda because... And that's the extraordinary thing. The thing about hot hatchbacks is they should... They just shouldn't be as good as they are because they're driven at the wrong end. All their mass is at the wrong end. You know, they are. They should be hopeless, and you shouldn't be able to engineer your way out of a disadvantage as substantial as that. Particularly, as you say, when you know you're comparing yourself to, you know, low slung, two seat, light sports cars with, you know, an engine at one end and driven wheels down the other, you know, the perfect configuration for having fun on the road. And yet we know that some of these cars are so good that when you factor in the fact that you can actually go and use them, you can put, you know, your children in the back, you can go shopping in them, you go on holiday in them, you know, they're quiet and they're comfortable and they just work in your daily life. You know, that's why, you know, many, many more hatchbacks are sold than little sports cars, because they just work.
Yeah, and the best hot hatches are exceptionally well-rounded machines. They're so broadly capable. I think that's one of the reasons I like them so much. And also, you look at the level of engineering, the quality of the engineering that several manufacturers are throwing at these apparently quite humble cars. It's extraordinary. Yeah, you mentioned the Civic Type R. I think that's a great car, easily the best Civic Type R that they've done for me. And I think it's brilliant to drive. And then you start looking at Nürburgring lap times. I think we've addressed how irrelevant Nürburgring lap times are in the past, but nonetheless, the fact that something that's based on a front-wheel drive, everyday family hatchback is capable of getting around that place within 8 minutes, as several hot hatches
ridiculous.
Are.
Anybody bonkers. Who's been to the Nürburgring and has some understanding of just how fast you've got to drive to get around there in less than 8 minutes. It is bonkers. But you're right. You know, I go back to the Focus only because it's what's uppermost in my mind at the moment. It's because it's parked outside. But you know, I drive cars quite a lot, as you do, and I've got a reasonably good idea when I get into a car of where the money's been spent, and the amount of money that Ford have spent on tuning that chassis, or they've just got geniuses doing it, because it's so unreasonably good. It is so capable. And I'm not just talking about grip, I'm talking about its poise and its accuracy and its balance and its feel. It is extraordinary for a car that costs, you know, 30 grand. And, you know, it's almost as if, well, I suspect this does have something to do with it. You know, they kind of knew there wasn't going to be an RS version of this generation of Focus, and they just thought, well, okay, so this has to be the standard bearer for now. So we really do need, it can't be the sort of the second stringer, the sort of, you know, fast forward light that it's been in the past. This has to stand up to represent, you know, that kind of car for its entire generation. And certainly dynamically, it's absolutely nailed it.
What about the other side of the coin? Long motorway journey, driving through town, all that stuff.
Good enough. You know, it's actually, you know, I'm a bloke in his mid-50s. I'm not the target buyer for those sorts of cars. And I can remember when I was, you know, even things like, you know, 205s, you know, the one I've got, it'll settle on the motorway at, you know, whatever speed you want to do at the motorway. I mean, the thing is, it's good enough. I mean, these cars are, you know, they're not, you know, rock hard. They can be quiet, they can be reasonably comfortable. You know, few of them are completely brilliant, but, you know, there aren't very many that I can think of where you just think to yourself, actually, this car is just too uncivilized. I mean, there are some, you know, those two-seat Renaults and Mini GPs and that sort of thing, where you just think they really have completely forgotten what these cars are, you know, should be about. In the interest of getting some kind of, you know, crazy lap time out of it. But in the main, you know, I think that's part of the formula, that's part of the deal, is that you, whatever you do, you don't destroy the very reason that people are interested in that configuration of car in the first place.
Yeah. I want to talk about a hot hatch that you have mentioned briefly already. And this is because I suspect, I don't know if you were on staff still at the time, or, well, I know you were at least contributing to Autocar at the time that the original Ford Focus RS came out. And do you remember there was sort of all sorts of differing opinions between magazines and probably between staffers on the same magazine as to whether this thing was good or not? I remember some people saying it's a liability, it feels dangerous on the road, and others saying it was genius. Where do you stand on that, and can you explain why some people saw it so differently?
I can't. I never saw it like that. I just thought it was wondrous from the get-go. I can remember, because I happen to have a bit of context here. I can remember, actually, I had an M3 CSL, some of you listening will know that Chris Harris and I live not far apart from each other. And he had a Focus RS, and I think it might have been his Autocar Long Term or something, I can't remember, but anyway, we did swapsies and we went for a drive, and Chris, as I'm sure all of you will know, doesn't hang about. And I can just remember sitting in this Focus, having never driven it before, sitting on the back of Chris Harris driving an N3 CSL, probably as fast as he was comfortable driving it. And Chris is a quicker, better driver than me. And just being able to sit there without making any great effort at all and just thinking, this is incredible. Because that's the, you know, that's the best that BMW can do with its sort of ultimate nameplate, the M3. And here I am sitting in a fast Ford and I'm just sitting there quietly keeping up with him, not taking anything out of myself, not taking anything out of the car. I thought it was one of those cars. I thought it was, you know, in its era, probably as impressive as the 205 was in its era. And I don't understand, unless, you know, sometimes you find with these things, there's something wrong with a press car. And one set of people get one press car and you get the other one and they think it's rubbish because, I don't know, someone's, you know, curbed it and deranged the front suspension or whatever and it doesn't feel right. I never thought it was scary. I never thought it was, you know, dangerous or anything like it. I just thought it was a really good, fast, fun, engaging hatchback. And, you know, probably until this ST, I would say certainly of the Focuses, Fiestas are different because I love those too. It's the best one they've done.
Wow, interesting. It's so funny. I remember it really vividly, reading all those reviews all those years ago. And I also remember Autocar published a letter from one Jay Clarkson, who I think he was writing about something else. And in a postscript, he said, by the way, the Ford Focus RS is a liability. So I also wonder if people actually weren't quite used to the concept of a front-wheel drive car with a lumpy, torquey turbocharged engine and quite a tightly wound diff, and you know, perhaps a few people drove it on particular roads in the wet and found it quite fighty. I don't actually have an opinion for myself because I've just not driven one. It's one of those cars that has escaped me.
I think you'll find that Ford Public Affairs have one on their historic fleet, and I think it is part of your automotive education to ring them up the moment we end this podcast and make sure that you do, because, you know, otherwise you're just not qualified to talk on these subjects.
Okay, I'll get that done right away, sir. Okay, you've mentioned already the Ford Focus RS, the Mark III. We are going to come back to that a little bit later on. Clearly, you think that was a bit of a clunker. But we spend so much time praising great cars on this podcast. I think maybe we should call out some of the not so great hot hatches. What comes to mind? 147 GTA, is that fair?
147 GTA. Okay, more recently, the latest Megane Trophy, the £72,000 thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of funny on paper. And when you drive it, for what it is, which is a front-wheel drive hatchback, it does absolutely amazing things. I don't want to take that away. It does amazing things, and it will record an amazing lap time. And it all works terribly well until you think about what else you could be driving for that kind of money. And the word, you know, given that it's only got two seats, and it's not long before the word Cayman turns up in your head, at which stage the conversation ends. And, you know, cars like that, I just, you know... fine, if they're brand builders, and if there are some people who that sort of thing floats their boat, then absolutely fine. But to me, just a sort of a standard Megane Trophy is just an infinitely better car than that. Yeah, the Alpha 147 GTA, yeah, lovely engine. Very little about the rest of it that I liked. Let's talk Mark III Golf GTI. Oh. I mean, jeez.
After, I mean, the Mark that was 1 a car, and 2 in particular.
After the one, after the 1 and the 2. So, you know, I think this was back in the era when hot hatches were getting nicked a lot. And so they decided that they'd just make them so boring to drive that nobody would want to steal them. And
that's the best kind of security system, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that was just an insult to the badge. It really, really was. The Mark IV wasn't much better either. There have been cars, you won't remember the Fiesta RS Turbo of, oh God, when I don't know, it would be early 1990s, I guess. I can remember thinking the only thing I liked about that car were its seats. It had these huge, chunky, it had some brilliant Recaros in it. And I think Autocar had a long-termer, and I just hated it. I just hated it with every fibre of my being, apart from those seats, which are jolly comfortable. So I'm sure I would go and sort of sit in it in the car park. I didn't want to drive the thing. There have been plenty of them over time. In fact, most of them, actually, if you think about it, because so the thing with so many hot hatchbacks, it's a bandwagon which so many manufacturers jumped on. And you just forget. You just forget all those, I don't know, all those Astras and, stuff like that, which just never really quite did it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair enough.
Fiat Tipo GTI. I mean,
just an insult to those three letters, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's accentuate the positive, because there have been plenty of nice ones, too.
Okay, so we've spoken a little bit about some of those more extreme hot hatches, or they call themselves hot hatches. I don't think they are. The two-seat ones. So it all started, didn't it, really, with the Mégane R26R, which, in isolation, I really love that car. I think it's brilliant. Great fun. But I don't consider it a hot hatch, because without that level of practicality, without that rear bench, that bench seat, it's just nothing like as usable for me as a hot hatch should be. And I therefore think it's something else. It's a weird hatchback, front-wheel drive sports car or something, I don't know.
Yes, it's a two-seat sports car. Yeah, like a Porsche Cayman is a two-seat sports car, and those, you know, and given that that's what certainly the latest one, that's what it's priced against. That's what it should be compared to, because you know nobody buys that latest Mégane to do the school run to go shopping, because you know you can't get anything in it. So you can only buy it as a driving machine, and therefore it should be compared against other driving machines that are available for that sort of money. And that is where those cars always fall down to me. And I'd just much rather have, the one which is, half the price, but 95% as fast, which you can actually get in and use.
Yeah, I do agree. One of the best ones of those, whatever they are, that I've driven, is the Volkswagen Golf GTI. No, sorry. Yes, the GTI Club Sport S, which had a 310 horsepower engine. Still front-wheel drive, of course, no rear seats, super clever diff, and they spent God knows how much money on the suspension at each corner. And it was an extraordinary machine, and Michelin Cup 2 tyres as well. It was a brilliant thing, but again, not really a hot hatch. Actually, that was one of the best launch events that I've ever done, because they
was
did
that
it
at the Nürburgring.
They
one?
Did it at the Nürburgring on the Nordschleife. Yeah,
I was there.
Oh, you were there. Oh, yes, you were there. I remember. I do remember now. And we... Oh, God. Okay, so I can tell this story now a bit more modestly, because you were there as well, and you'll have the same story. So we were doing Ducks and Drakes around the 13-mile Nordschleife with... What's his name? Benny Lechner or something?
Can't remember.
Do you remember little Benny? Short Benny? He was the guy who... A racing driver who set the Club Sport S's Nürburgring lap time. It broke the front-wheel drive production car lap record with something like a 7:50, and we just bonkers. And we had so he was leading, yeah. And we had three or four of us in identical cars behind, and he would. What did we do? Maybe we did one warm-up lap and then a quicker lap. And if you got lucky, and the other journalists in your group were up for going quickly as well, you really, really got on it. And I remember having to work bloody hard. I think I was second in the line, immediately behind Steve Sutcliffe. And of course, it's the first car behind the lead car that determines the pace. If that car drops right back, the lead Correct. Car will slow down. But if that car is on the lead car's tail, you go quickly. And given it was Sutcliffe,
and you lead all the others behind.
Exactly.
You.
And given it was Sutcliffe, we were going hard, and it was extraordinary how quickly a Golf could get around this place. And we spoke to Benny at the end, and he said he reckoned that we were around 30 seconds off his record-breaking lap pace, which, 30 seconds and we're going that fast. I couldn't really believe that. But
do you know what? It's not that much. It really isn't that much. If you consider how well Benny knows the Nürburgring compared to you, and if you consider how well he knows that car compared to you, and if you consider that it's a 13-mile lap, So, you know, if it was a 1.3 mile lap, like, I don't know, the Indy Circuit at Brands, that 30 seconds becomes 3 seconds, and then suddenly it doesn't seem so much at all. It's a very good point.
Yeah, you do make a good point.
So pat yourself on the back, you're bloody fast.
And it made me think, okay, well, we've just done an 8-minute 20 around this place, which is, does seem quick,
rapid,
doesn't it?
In a Volkswagen Golf.
Bonkers. Anyway, we shouldn't be talking about these cars because they're not hot hatches.
No. Move on.
Okay, let's move on to rally refugees. These are...
We're going to disagree about. But pray continue.
Okay. Well, these aren't hot hatches either.
I wasn't going to say that. No, I was going to. I was about to interject with a particular car, which I suspect you will like more than me.
Oh, I know which one.
I always forget how young you are. You may not have driven one of these, but
I have.
Do continue.
I know what you're going to say. So these are Group A era rally replicas. Yeah. Things like the Nissan Sunny GTIR Integrale. So these are four-wheel drive turbo hot hatches, and the Escort RS Cosworth.
Yes,
I had that right, didn't I? You're not a fan.
I'll tell you something else.
Go on.
I'm not a massive fan of the Integrale.
Oh my! Ooh.
I get into, every time I say this, I get into so much trouble because I mean I know that there will be Integrale owners listening to this who will forever view me and throw their okay, let me be very careful about this. And that's not true. I really like Integrales. I think they are great. No, I think they're good cars. I think they do the job pretty well. But I've never fallen in love with an Integrale. And I've driven at least one example of every kind there has been from before they were called Integrales, when they were just called the Lancia HF4WD. I mean, when I started Autocar, you know, Integrales, we had a long-term Integrale the day I joined Autocar, and I grew up through all of that. I think I've spoken on a previous podcast about the last really significant accident I had was 28 years ago now, blimey, in an Integrale, and that was one of the, you know, the Evo cars, and that's not why I'm a bit down on Integrales. I've never felt that sense of involvement and fun from them. I've been objectively impressed by them, and I like them a lot more than an Escort RS, but they just never quite did it for me. And you know, I drove one, we did a thing at Autocar called the Hot Hatch World Cup, which was ridiculous, but you got to earn a living somehow. And we went through various rounds of various countries, entering various cars, and the final ended up being the Integrale versus a 205 GTI. And I didn't own a 205 GTI at the time, so it wasn't like I was feathering my own nest. In fact, quite the reverse, because I was probably pushing up the price of 205 GTIs at the time I wanted to buy one. But we had an Integrale, a really lovely Evolution Integrale, and we had a 205 GTI, which is actually quite an old car with a six-figure number of miles on its clock. And it was just funnier. It was just a more fun car to drive. There, I've said it.
Off your chest. Well, there we go. You've reduced our podcast audience by half, but at least you're being truthful.
But let me get stuck into the Escort while we're here.
Well, get rid of the other half.
Exactly. I'm sorry, guys. I was such an enormous fan of the Sierra Cosworth. And because I knew that underneath it, the Escort was actually a Sierra, and they just stuck an Escort badge on it because that's kind of what they had to do. I just thought this was going to be amazing. And they ruined it. I probably only drove two, but I can't believe they were both wrong. And they just understeered. They just understeered and understeered and understeered.
And body rolled.
And, you know, the engine. Yeah, and the engines of those things, they were always, you know, just tools for doing a job. There was never anything nice about that 2-litre Cosworth four-cylinder turbo thing, and I just never got it. I mean they look quite cool, but in many regards that made it worse, because it kind of, you know, the car wrote a check, or the looks wrote a check that the car beneath couldn't cash. I've never got it. I've never understood them. Really disappointing car.
God, Fords really have had some one or two shockers, and a few of the greats as well.
It was a Ford. It was my when I was 17 and I had a 2CV. My mate Ben, because he was, well, frankly, wealthier than me, he had an XR2. He had an original circular headlight, Mark One pepper pot wheel, Fiesta XR2. And just occasionally, usually because he was pissed and he needed driving home, I get to drive the XR2. And it was just fabulous. I mean, that's kind of what got me onto hot hatches to begin with. And I think there have been loads of really, really good ones since. And yeah, and quite a few that weren't.
Mm. Okay, well, let's talk...
Not many average ones. Anyway, go on.
Let's talk about some of the better, more recent Ford hot hatches, the Fiestas, the current and the previous Fiesta ST. Both just brilliant little things.
Because, see, if somebody said to you, Dan, bad news is... you've got one of these and you can't drive anything else for the rest of your days. I mean, you'd be a bit put out, but you'd be thinking, but yeah, actually, in terms of what you want from a car, it kind of just, it's fast and it's fun and it puts a smile on your face. I mean, if on a, you know, on a Monday morning, you look out the window and what is sitting there waiting for you puts a smile on your face, it's kind of job done for a car, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is.
And, you know, those two STs in particular did that. So which one do you prefer? Do you prefer the older car with the four-cylinder engine, but the perhaps slightly sharper handling, or do you prefer the newer one with that lovely triple in it, but a little bit less incisive, I suppose?
I've had a better drive. I've had more fun overall in the earlier one. And I'll always have a connection with that car because it was the first... Was it the first small hot hatch I loved? No, it wasn't really, but I don't know. It blew the competition away as far as I was concerned, and it just made me sit up and go, wow, this is how good a small hot hatch can be. I remember thinking that so it handled beautifully and it had a really good punchy engine, but also in the details, it was like a Porsche. And I mean, control weights, the way they were matched, how consistent the responses were, all that stuff. It was...
You got the impression, didn't you, that the people who set that up really knew what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And not only did they know what they were doing, they understood the context. So they weren't setting it up for a lap time. They weren't setting it up to make them look like superheroes. They were when they set it up, they were thinking of guys like you and me. And that's what I so love. And believe me, I don't know when you last had a good go in a Focus ST, but you know, that's exactly the same feeling you get in the ST too. You just think... This car is so... I don't know what it'd be like on a track. I haven't driven it around a track yet. It might not be very good, but on the road, it is... Yeah, it's just fantastic.
That's the thing about the Fiesta STs. They had their priorities right because it's good on track. But if you go chasing a lap time, if you're giving it everything on track, they get a little bit ragged.
Yes,
but on the road, at quick road speeds, they're magical. They did the launch of the Fiesta ST 200, which was the later, slightly more powerful version of the previous shape. And they did that down in the south of France. And we took it, we charged over from wherever we flew into, maybe it was Nice Airport, and we charged over to the Route Napoleon. And I spent a day in the summer, in gorgeous weather, nailing this thing back and forth along the Route Napoleon. And it was just spellbindingly good. I always thought that if I needed an everyday car... that had to, you know, occasionally carry people in the back and stuff in the boot, and it was my money, that's what I'd have. It's great that car demonstrates that actually a really brilliant performance car doesn't need to be expensive.
No, I completely agree with you. To me, it's kind of like on a completely different and much lower level. It's almost like a sort of, you know, a BMW M2 comp. It's the sort of compact junior member of the team, which just shows that actually you don't need more than that, because it's not about how fast you go, it's about how much fun you have going fast. I completely agree. I think those things do it brilliantly.
Okay, from Ford to Vauxhall, and just want to know if you've ever really liked a Vauxhall hot hatch.
Yeah, really liked. No, not really
quite liked.
Quite liked a few. The original, God, Astra GTE. I had an MG Metro, which having an MG Metro meant was you could turn up at a Vauxhall dealer and they'd let you test drive an Astra GTE. Because if you turned up in anything else, if you just turned up a normal Metro, they wouldn't have looked at you. But they thought it was just possible that an MG Metro owner could be thinking about trading up. So that's basically how I got my kicks when I was a kid. I just used to go around to car dealers in my Metro and go, can I have a drive in this? And you'd be surprised at how many different things I did manage to get into. So yeah, those. What else? There's, I can't remember which one. There was a Corsa VXR, which wasn't that terrible. I know I'm damning with faint damning, but things like the current, you know, the current Astra VXR. You know, it's a good car, but the problem is, it's the perennial Vauxhall thing, isn't it? You know, being good isn't good enough. You know, when you're out there, when you've got, you know, the current Golf GTI, you've got the Focus ST, you've got a Civic Type R, you know, just being pretty good and thinking, oh, well, that's they've done okay there. Well, there you haven't, because these cars are, the best are so good. If you're not up there among them, then you kind of think, well, what's the point? You know, every car, so I'm just going to go off on one for a minute here. Every car that's on sale, regardless of what it is, there has to have a reason where a certain person in a certain set of circumstances would be able to look at it and think, that's the car for me. Above anything else that's out there, that's the car that I should buy because it works for me in a way that nothing else does. And I just don't get that about those cars. I mean, you know, it may be that there's some great finance deal you can get it, so they work on that way. But as a thing, as an object, as a car to get in and drive, I don't think I have ever driven a fast Vauxhall, which I would say was even close to, let alone the best car in its class.
Mm. Perhaps that's why Vauxhall hasn't bothered with a fast Astra VXR for a few years. My first long-termer at Evo magazine, you go to Evo and you think you're going to get, oh good, I'm going to get an M3 here or maybe a 911 or so. I had a Vauxhall Corsa, but it was a VXR. I love the optimistic use of this badge. It was a VXR Club Sport.
what was the Club Sport element? What made it a Club Sport?
It had a few bits and pieces. So it had some uprated brakes. Maybe they were Brembos. I don't think they were, actually. I can't remember. And it had maybe some Bilstein dampers, and it had a Drexler LSD. So it had, a fair amount of kit.
Yeah, it's proper stuff, actually.
Yeah, some really good kit chucked at it. And it was an interesting car, that. I think it was 22 grand when the equivalent Fiesta was 16. So, immediately, ooh, it was a bit of a no-hoper.
Yeah.
It also had a shonky interior and a very, very bouncy, unsettled ride and a not particularly satisfying engine. However, I did a hill climb at Gerston Down, which I think is in Dorset or somewhere around there, which is a really cool hill climb. Gerston Down, it's almost hinted at in its name, is one of the few hill climbs in the country that starts off downhill. Away from the line, you just drop down for, 50, 100 metres or something, and then you start sweeping uphill again. And I did this hill climb school day at this place in my Corsa VXR Club Sport. And it was brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. We had, hot hatches are well suited to that kind of thing anyway, but there were dozens of other people and other cars there, almost all of them more powerful, more exotic machines. And the Corsa was the quickest thing all day, by a margin.
That's the driver. That's the driver for you, though. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with the car.
No. It was me. It was the car, because with that diff, it was extraordinary. The thing just wouldn't understeer. All you would do is, you'd fling it into a corner faster than it should be able to get around, and then nail the throttle, and the diff would hook up and drag you through. This is a little bit of tooting of my own horn here, but I'm going to say it. One of the instructors, they were watching from halfway up the course, and he said that as I came through, and I really do think it is just the car that did this with that diff. They said that as I came through and turned into one of the corners, they all took a step back because they thought I was off. And I said to them, actually, do you know what? I knew it was fine because that diff just drags you out of trouble. It was extraordinary. And so ever since that day, I've had a kind of soft spot for those cars, even though I know objectively they're not that good.
Yeah, and a Fiesta would have just been, that much better again, presumably.
Yeah, it would have been. Maybe not faster up that hill climb, because certainly the earlier one doesn't have a diff. But
just more fun.
Yeah, it would have been more fun. Okay, well, before we wind this down, let's have that row that we promised we'd have about the Mark III Focus RS. Do you want to just give us 30 seconds just to remind us on why you didn't like it?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think I kind of already shot my bolt on this, but basically it was just, it was everything which you know, I don't want a hot hatch to be. It was four-wheel drive, it was turbocharged, and it was heavy. A really heavy car. And I can remember at the time, they're saying, oh, yes, I know, but we've done this, that, and the other to disguise it. Well, they hadn't. And I know it was quick in a straight line, and I know that it had lots of power. And I didn't hate it. I really didn't hate it at all. I just didn't think it was anything like as good as everybody else did. And frankly, I didn't think it was anything like as good as some previous Ford hot hatchbacks have been, particularly the Mark 1 Focus RS. So, yeah, it's not so much that, as I say, I didn't like it. It's just that when I got to it, I wasn't first or even close to being first to it, having read what everybody else had said about it, I can remember just getting in it and thinking, they've been driving a different car because this does not compute. What they are talking about ain't the car I'm driving. But it quite clearly was. And obviously you take a different view.
Well, this isn't going to be much of an argument because I mostly agree with what you're saying. There are certain things that were, I think, unforgivable. Like the seating position. There were two seat options, and I think one of the seat options was worse, less good. The seat just mounted so high, high enough that I just kept checking, thinking there must be a lever somewhere. I must be able to lower this seat. And you couldn't. And also the engine, that 2.3 turbocharged engine, was very flat, just pretty uninteresting. It never really got going and lit up, you know, through to the red line. It's quite a bland thing. However, I will also say it was the most overhyped car that I've been aware of in my time in this industry. There were people left, right and centre declaring it the greatest hot hatch of all time, which clearly it wasn't.
Absolute cobbles.
Yeah, exactly. But what I liked about it, and I think it probably was because it was four-wheel drive, is that if you got it on a good sweeping road, so a B road or an A road with good sweeping corners rather than a very stop-start one, I got into this rhythm, and I've done it a couple of times in Focus RSs, of turning into a corner and feeling the car, even on the way in, but certainly on the way out, neutralise, and under power, it begin just to slightly slide out as you get through the apex and through to the exit of the corner. And it was a sensation that I've not actually experienced in a four-wheel drive hot hatch before. And I adored it. I loved that sensation. I remember doing cornering shots, so back and forth in one of these cars through the same corner. And by the end of it, the roads, even though I wasn't doing, you know, power slide shots, the road was just smeared with tire rubber, where the car had been skating in this kind of neutral balance through the corner. And it was just that sensation that made me quite like that car. Although,
okay, well,
yeah, I do accept that it was flawed in many, many other ways.
Well, I mean, it may be that I never drove it in that kind of environment. I mean, I can remember driving it on quite good roads, but I can also remember driving it on a track. And I can remember you kind of had to, sort of bully it on the track. I mean, you could, it either just kind of went fairly doggedly where you pointed it, or you could really lob it, and then it'd be almost like it would think, oh right, okay, so he wants to drift a bit now, so we better do that. But it always felt a bit sort of, what's the word, it's not mechanical, it didn't feel natural. Forced is the word.
I can't really argue with that. We're gonna have to try harder in future to have arguments.
this is an argument, this is a question, because I'm not actually sure what my opinion is on this. Golf GTI or Golf R. So, you know, 300 horsepower rather than 230, four-wheel drive rather than front-wheel drive. I mean, with all that we have been saying through this podcast, you would expect us to go, oh, no, the Golf GTI is the one because it's front-wheel drive and it's lighter and it's purer, and you don't need all that extra power. But do you know what? I love a Golf R. I really do. I've had some of my best drives of recent years in sort of, you know, cross-country roads in bad weather in Golf R's. So, yeah, I don't know what to think. What do you think?
Yeah, I ran one at Evo for a year, and a brilliant thing all around. I think it's worth noting that not all GTIs were born equal, because you need to have the performance pack, I think they call it. You get a bit more power and a diff, I think. And better brakes.
The diff is so important.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. And then I think a Golf GTI gives the R a real run for its money. But, yeah, if it was me, I think I'd probably take the R. So maybe it is the exception to the hot hatch rule, but there will inevitably be some. Okay, well, let's wind this podcast up by having a quick think about where we are with hot hatches now and what the near future might bring for them. I mean, one of the trends that we've seen recently is for me, hot hatches that sort of stretch the definition just as much as those two-seat hot hatches do, because is a 50 grand, 400 horsepower hot hatch really a hot hatch, or is it the hyper hatch or something else?
You're talking about an A45 AMG, presumably.
Exactly, that sort of thing, an RS3, yeah.
And RS3s. That's a good question, and I wish I knew you were going to ask it, because I think they are, because I don't know what disqualifies them. I mean, if you say that a Mark III Focus RS is a hot hatchback, I can't really see why an A45S isn't. It's a different sort of hatchback. That's a hatchback I actually like, I think, more than a lot of others do. I thought it was a really pretty capable thing, and obviously very rapid. So, yeah, I think it probably is. But in a way, certainly, that those two-seat hatchbacks are not.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, for me, it's the affordability point. You know, 50K is not within realistic reach.
No, you're absolutely right.
But I mean, I can acknowledge that they are phenomenally fast, those things now. And actually, I've not driven the new A45S, but yeah, people, not least yourself, do tell me that it's very, very good.
Yeah, I mean, the A35 is no great shit. So the A35, I guess, is not the Golf GTI, is it? It's the Golf R, but then the A45 is the Golf RR, if you like. The A35 is nothing right home about at all, but the A45 is quite a weapon, definitely.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, well, let's very quickly cover off the future of the hot hatch, which probably we're talking about hybridity. And given that we've agreed mostly that brilliant hot hatches are simple, light, not too powerful. I mean, it's not entirely encouraging, is it, that presumably we're going to be carting, you know, a big electric motor and a heavy stack of batteries around in these cars soon.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think they'll keep off for as long as they possibly can, because, you know, hybrids not only add weight, but they add cost too. And, you know, you can't be charging lots of money for your hot hatchbacks. And that's one of the things that we love about them, is they're just so accessible. So, I mean, for me, I think we are actually in a pretty good era for hot hatch, because, you know, if I think about it, you know, I can, without thinking very hard at all, name 10 really decent hot hatchbacks that are on the market, you know, from, you know, right down the bottom, sort of, you know, Suzuki Swifts up to, you know, A45S. So I think that this is a pretty good era for the hot hatch. And so I think people at the moment kind of understand what the market wants and what people want. And I can't see in the short term that changing too much. In the longer term, yeah, I don't know. I worry about all sorts of genres being, you know, messed over by hybrids, you know, supercars being among them. But, yeah, I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah. Well, we've had, I don't know, what did we say? Okay, well, let's just agree for the sake of argument that 1976 was the year the hot hatch was born. So we've had almost 50 years of great and some not so great hot hatches. But long may it continue, because they add such vibrancy and such life to the performance car market. And I just hope that I get to keep driving them for the rest of my days. Do you want to put your neck on the line and declare one the greatest of all the hot hatches?
Well, you know what I'm going to say, don't you?
You're going to say the Escort RS Cosworth.
Exactly correct, yes.
205 GTI, I suppose.
It is a 1.9 205 GTI. You know, I haven't driven all of them, but I've probably, yeah, I must have driven the vast majority of them, and I've certainly never driven anything that, I think I said earlier in the podcast, to me captures the essence of what that sort of car should be better than that.
There we go. A good definitive answer there. Okay, all right, well, let's leave it there. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Andrew, for your time as well. And please remember, everyone, that you can find Drive Nation on Instagram at DriveNation_. If you want more from us, go and support us on Patreon at patreon.com/DriveNation. There'll be a link to that in the description of this podcast. And a huge thank you, as ever, to everybody who has supported us on Patreon. It really does make a difference. And we'll be back to talk to you again next week.
Yeah, look forward to it very much.
Bye, everyone.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.